the elevator pitch for DMT is that it instantaneously transports you, you know, within a few seconds into an alternate reality that bears no relationship whatsoever to the normal waking world, that has no, in many cases, often no referent whatsoever. And it's not only the strangest world you couldn't possibly have imagined, but an abundantly populated world, populated by apparently super intelligent beings that are neither human nor animal nor anything else, that you can verbalize, that you can English. And that, to me, is a great mystery.
I'm so excited to get into this conversation because this is something that fascinates me, and it kind of draws upon a lot of intersections of my own research and fascinations into consciousness in general. What is the world's strangest drug?
Well, that's debatable, I guess, but it's a very good title. So I couldn't have said arguably the world's strangest drug, or possibly the world's strangest drug. Well, there could be a number of contenders, but in this case, I'm talking about DMT, of course, which I think makes a case for being, if not the strangest drug, certainly up there. Well, not just strangest drug, but I think strangest experience. This side of the yawning grave, as Terence McKenna used to say.
Someone that I believe borrowed that quote from for your title of Death by Astonishment, correct?
Absolutely. It was going to be called something else. I forgot the original title, Something Bad. Then it came to me. It's like, obviously, it was one of his most famous lines. You know, the only risk with DMT is death by astonishment, which kind of sounds like ridiculous hyperbole. But you know, if you actually use DMT, anyone who's actually experienced DMT, it doesn't feel like hyperbole. It almost feels like you might well die by astonishment. You know? Astonishment is a very rare emotion, perhaps the rarest of emotions. Most people don't really ever experience true astonishment in their lives, I think, and DMT will deliver it on tap.
A lot of people that listen to my podcast, if they haven't experienced DMT, have certainly researched it and understand a lot of the effects and testimonies. But there will be people listening who have that idea of, well, it's just a hallucinogenic. It's just you see things, pretty patterns, pretty images. Maybe you have some voices in your head. So can you explain why this is such a difference with this particular drug?
Where do I start? I mean, it's kind of a difficult question. I mean, basically, well, it's a difficult question in the there's a lot to say, right? But you know, in the elevator pitch for DMT is that it instantaneously transports you, you know, within a few seconds into an alternate reality that bears no relationship whatsoever to the normal waking world, that has no, in many cases, often no referent whatsoever. And it's not only the strangest world you couldn't possibly have imagined, but an abundantly populated world, populated by apparently super intelligent beings that are neither human nor animal nor anything else, that you can verbalize, that you can English. And that, to me, is a great mystery. It's an enigma of how such an experience is even possible. And why this simple plant alkaloid that's kind of ubiquitous throughout the natural world, found in countless plant species, Dennis McKenna maintains probably in all plant species if we bother to look for it, this, you know, simple plant molecule can occasion these experiences so efficiently, with kind of ferocious efficiency and reliability. That's not easy to explain, and it isn't easy. I mean, you can say, yeah, it's just, it's an illusory social event, as one neuroscientist put it on Twitter, which I found absolutely fucking hilarious, you know.
I'll assume he has not taken it himself.
Of course. Well, that's the problem, isn't it, is that a lot of these people who provide, you know, offer their explanations for DMT, have no experience with it. And so to him, when people say, oh, I saw a being, an entity, he just imagines you saw, you know, a little green man or something. And yes, an illusory social event. It's illusory, of course. You know, obviously it's not real. Come on. It's not real, an intelligent being. You're hallucinating. It's an illusion. You should really say hallucinatory social event. But anyway, we'll let that slide. But no, I mean, that idea is just silly. But what I tried to do, I think, is try to actually deconstruct and analyze these alternative explanations and say, why do I think the hallucination explanation doesn't work, or the, you know, exotic waking dream imagery and, you know, whatever else, archetypal structures bubbling up from the collective psyche, you know, Jungian, this sort of neo-Jungian model that's become sort of de rigueur in psychedelic circles of late, in the last, well, quite a while. But, you know, I try to, in the book, as you know, I take each of these apart and say, okay, do these offer satisfying explanations for the DMT state? And I find them to be wanting, to say the least. And so then we have to look for alternative explanations.
We do. And I find it fascinating as well that you have this such a radical, like you said, such a radical change from reality in every way that could be described. And yet it is so widely distributed through nature, including being endogenous to our own biosystem, which would suggest that it is a very integral, very fundamental element of something in reality. And the fact that you have such a radical departure from your default perception would suggest to me, at least, that it's almost like a membrane, and you are passing through some form of a membrane that is in some form connected to reality in a fundamental way.
I do lean towards now the position that you're interacting or interfacing with some kind of intelligence, but I don't, the kind of naive way of thinking about it, that you're kind of moving, you're peeking through into their world, I don't think is quite correct. I don't necessarily think that these entities have a form that could be faithfully represented visually, and there's no reason to think that they would. You know, if you see a jaguar or an anaconda type entity or reptilian or whatever, the idea that a discarnate entity would actually possess the form of an embodied earthly creature doesn't really make any sense in my mind. We suggest that they are kind of using those forms, which in neuroscience speak suggests that they are manipulating this world building machinery, as I call it.
Like it's an interface, but it's an interface that's filtered through archetypes that the brain is recognizing and using as a way to explain it.
That could also be part of it, yes. I think the brain could be drawing upon archetypal structures. I mean, archetypes, that's a deep question. I devote a whole chapter in the book to that. But yes, basically, your brain has to find ways of representing it, or your brain has to be induced to generate certain types of imagery that make sense to you, that you can recognize as a being. You know, and a lot of times these intelligences, there's a real sense of them kind of showing off, so to speak. They like to show you kind of what's possible if you let them take control. Not that you've got much choice in the matter, but often there's this great performance, and it's often described as such, and them displaying these impossible hyperdimensional objects and performing these incredibly dynamic, staggeringly dynamic and complex sort of elfin machinations in front of you. You know, this is, it's clearly, I think they are showing off to an extent. I don't think that's really what this other place is, but I think they're just using your brain and kind of generating that kind of imagery just to kind of show off, so to speak.
I mean, Terence would tend to say that he got the inclination that they were trying to send a message or trying to push something into humanity. Like, you can do this as well. That's something he would mention a lot with his own experiences with these strange entities that, like you said, would perform almost like linguistic manifestation of higher dimensional objects and try and get you to use your own vocalizations to, you know, manifest these incredible things. And I believe Terence got the impression that there was almost a sense of urgency.
Well, there's certainly a sense of urgency. I mean, often that's because the experience is, you know, temporarily very limited. And so they seem quite aware of that, which is kind of interesting. They seem so eager. And it's like, I was speaking to Dennis McKenna just the other day, and the question always comes up of, if they really wanted to tell us something, why don't they just give it to us straight, so to speak? And that doesn't seem to be the game here. The message doesn't seem to be one of just giving you information in a straight way. It seems to be something more indirect. I think sometimes it is just for them to kind of show off and say, hey, you're not running the show here. You don't know shit compared to us. And they're kind of making that clear, whether they would, you know, we'd be capable of understanding at our current level of cognitive sophistication and development, whether we'd be capable of grokking any kind of deep message. I don't know. And so I think, yes, there is something there. I think there is, you know, on a longer time scale, it does seem as if we're being reminded of something, perhaps, reminded of our, a bit of a cliche, but you know, kind of our true nature, and that we are part of something bigger, and that we've lost the connection with that. But also it's simply a humbling message. It's a message of humility, of, you know, get over yourself, because yes, you have perhaps the potential in the future. Maybe this is what we're being pulled towards, you know, Terence McKenna's transcendental object at the edge of time, right? You know, there is a sense of that, and people often describe this familiarity as if they've been there before, or even if they haven't been there before, this sense of like a homecoming. There's this feeling of being welcomed with this great celebratory uproar when the lights are flashing and the bells are ringing and your name is being chanted by an elfin choir. You know, this kind of thing does go on. So they clearly, assuming we are dealing with some kind of intelligence, there is some connection between us and them, but we haven't quite worked out what that is, whether it's these are future humans or whether this is a place from which we came, and this is kind of a temporary state that we're in, this sort of collapsed into this lower dimensional form for a temporary period of time, and about, you know, ultimately we will return to those realms, maybe upon death, I don't know. It's hard to work out, but I think the kind of the most important message that we need to kind of take to heart at first is that we're not, you know, we don't have it all worked out. And I think that's the most difficult one for humanity to get to grips with and to kind of take to heart, is that we don't have it all worked out, and that we're not the top of the tree when it comes to intelligence, perhaps on Earth, perhaps not, but certainly not within the intelligent space of all reality. And I think we sometimes assume that to be the case.
I think it's fascinating the parallels as well between things like near-death experiences and transcendental experiences, and also even things like the paranormal and UFO experiences that are attributable in the sense of this awe-inspiring event that cannot be truly explained, and in some ways almost does feel like some higher entity showing off or trying to kind of give the human being this event that completely forces a form of catalytic event, I would say, because, you know, when it comes to either, you know, a UFO experience or paranormal experience, or even a very intense psychedelically induced experience, you know, there is a certain percentage of people, I think, that cannot deal with that, that cannot handle that type of an overload of perception. And so it's very much something where it's a choice in the brain of whether you're going to accept this and bring it into your worldview and start to expand your worldview, or if you're going to reject this and and try and hide away from these larger kind of hints at you know, the mosaic of reality. And there's not many people, I would say, that really want to dive deep into that mosaic of reality. A lot of us would rather just ignore that and try not to think about the big picture. These things force you into the big picture. And I think that's another thing that, you know, Terence McKenna would say, that it's a very democratic way of awakening people to a larger expanse of mind, because once you take this, you're going on that journey, and there's no way to you know, disregard that. When you have the experience, you can listen to all the tapes and all the lectures and watch documentaries, but when you have an experience, I think that's the most powerful teacher. And like you said, this is such a profound experience. Clearly it's trying to teach us something, and it's something that needs to be decoded. And I find it very interesting that, is it Imperial College London, right, that synthesized the DMTX, where it's intravenously used to kind of elongate the process?
Your first point, yeah, I think this, you know, John Mack called it ontological shock, and this way you're in the entire kind of ontological foundation of your reality is kind of instantaneously extirpated. You know, it's gone, and you are forced into a confrontation with the impossible, really, and forced, and you can reel from that, and you kind of bounce back from that and try and explain it away or forget about it. And that's what often happens, is that you will come back and you will remember nothing of the experience. At the time, it was, your mind was very much blown, and you were truly astonished that this is not possible, that I could be having this experience. And then it fades away, and that's like, almost feels like a safety mechanism. And then if you don't choose to do DMT again, you can let it slip, and then a few years later you'll look back and go, wow, that was a wild experience. I don't remember what happened, but I remember it was pretty crazy. But you can kind of slough it off, so to speak, and forget about it. But if you do choose to confront it and go back, then you're on a journey like no other. Getting to Imperial College, yes, the problem with DMT is that it's so brief, and this is mercifully brief for most people, and it's quite enough. Most people wouldn't want to spend more than 5, 6, 7 minutes within the space, and that's what you get. You know, that's the deal, so to speak. But it turns out that isn't necessarily the deal, which is where this kind of DMTX idea came from, which is myself and Rick Strassman. In 2015, we developed this model for stabilizing DMT. Because DMT is kind of weird. It's a weird psychedelic in a few different ways. It's not merely in being short-acting, but also in terms of its lack of subjective tolerance and its lack of the speed and efficiency with which it enters the brain and is cleared from the brain. And it has these pharmacological peculiarities that make it a perfect candidate for this technology, target controlled intravenous infusion technology. I sometimes say it's almost as if DMT was designed for that purpose, where its brevity of action is not a bug, but a feature, in fact. And so I thought, yeah, let's extend the experience. Let's induce people into the DMT state with an infusion and then hold them there for as long as they want. And then you can really kind of try to explore and analyze and perform experiments within the space and establish proper two-way communication with the beings within the space. And so we developed this model, myself and Rick. And then, yes, the Imperial College team were the first to actually implement it in human subjects just a couple of years ago now. And it worked, and it worked very well. And there weren't any casualties. They were able to keep them within the space for about 30 minutes. This has now been extended to much longer by other groups. But they were the first ones to kind of implement our model.
Is there any sort of radical encounters and testimonies from those experiments that differ because of the longevity of the experience? Like, is there anything very exciting that came from these testimonies?
I think it was like 11 subjects. We did a panel, myself and Graham Hancock moderated a panel with some of them, and there's lots of stories, lots of going on. There was two in particular, Anton Bilton. So he actually funded the study. He's this property tycoon turned consciousness explorer. runs the Turing Institute. You know, he paid for it, and he volunteered as well. And he found himself within, he always sees the same kind of entities. He calls them the gingerbread man. And when he enters their domain, during the infusion, he went through this kind of subterranean domain, very interesting. But anyway, and kind of worked his way through that into this, I think he called it like an Escher type room, you know, kind of usual idea of the dimensions are strange in this place. And these gingerbread men, there's like a family of gingerbread men that were kind of looking down on him. And they said they were checking the back of his neck. They kept checking the back of his neck, which he, for some reason, understood that they were checking if there was a cord attached to see if that he was, you know, still, if he died or something, or whether he was, you know, still connected to the other world, which is our world, I guess. And once they were satisfied that he hadn't, you know, passed permanently to their side of the veil, so to speak, they were showing him these. And it's interesting, I interviewed Anton, and he said they were showing me this jewel encrusted pad, and this technological device. And this is quite common, right? People go into this space, and these entities show them these, you know, this device, and say, "Look at this, use this." And what the fuck, you know, I don't know.
What are you talking about, man?
I don't know how they use this. What are you talking about? And that's an interesting, an interesting feature of the experience, right? This and recurring, and in one of Rick Strassman's subjects, who I also interviewed, and he's also in the book, Dimitri or Spiros, a Greek guy or Greek heritage, anyway. And he, one of his earlier trips during Strassman's study, they didn't just show him it. It was he couldn't get past the bloody thing. It was like in front of his face, this thing with dials and knobs and sliders and thing that he understood was a reality synthesizer. And they were like, "Go on, look at that, fucking look at this." I don't know how you, and he couldn't work out, of course, what, and that was the whole trip, was just him, this thing in his face. But then going back to Timothy Leary in the 1960s, one of his very first trips, he described them as like Venusian insect, elfin insect type beings. So you got the elf and the insect together. And they showed him a jewel encrusted pad. And I thought, oh, that's exactly the same words that Anton used, who knew nothing of this encounter. So they showed him this jewel encrusted pad. But of course, you know, Anton, this is in 2022 or whenever it was, and he couldn't make any sense of it. But what was cool about that is that as we kind of hoped and predicted, the DMT state kind of stabilized. So he was within that place for an extended period of time. So he was able to at least attempt to make some sense of this and spend time with these beings, these gingerbread and these little elfish gingerbread men, as he calls them, trying to make sense of it. Now, Anton is not an engineer, he's not a mathematician, he's not a linguist, but imagine sending in somebody who is, you know, a specialist in these kind of things, who can look at machinery and go, "Ah, I know what this means," or maybe not. But anyway, they would probably do much better than Anton could, And this is kind of where the whole DMTX kind of comes into its own, because you can send people in there who do have specialist expertise within certain domains, whether it's mathematicians or topologists or linguists or theologians or artists, right? You know, whatever, and allow them to spend time and to feed information back to the team on the other side in real time, delivering information, receiving questions, you know, maybe in an earpiece or something, and, you know, look at this, ask them this or whatever. And then it's like you are the deep sea explorer connected to the boat, you know, but you're far away, but you're connected, and you've got your communication device, and you can look around and you can do things and you can transmit information back to the team on the other side. And that's just it's such a cool, the potential of that is amazing, and but only because of this extended state technology. Without it, it's just too quick. You just have to rely on you know, verbal reports as you come back, but memory is always pretty poor within these experiences, for most people anyway. So I think, yeah. And then there was Carl Smith, who was, he was the only person, subject zero, so Professor Carl Smith, he was the only person who completed all of the five sessions or something with DMTX. I mean, he's a proper experienced psychonaut, so it's kind of nothing to him. Well, it wasn't nothing. I mean, even to him, it was kind of a bit much. But you know, he handled it, and every time he went back, he would see the same kinds of entities. But they became aware that he was coming back, and he sensed that they were kind of thinking, you know, not you again. And interestingly, when he was being scanned with the MRI machine or whatever they were using, I think it was MRI, the entities were aware of this, and they seemed, he said, they seemed confused because they're the ones who are normally doing the scanning. But this time it was the Imperial team doing the scanning, so they weren't quite sure what was going on or something like that. So,
you know, it's very interesting. I get, like you said, the deep sea diver. I had this image of someone on an umbilical cord just plunging into these very strange realms and trying to recover information, almost like a UFO piercing through into their reality, and they're confused because we're scanning them, we're studying them, we're researching them. And, you know, do you think that it's possible for them to enter into our reality the way that we enter into theirs? You know, think about all of these mysterious experiences throughout history, thousands and thousands of years, you know, flaming chariots and unexplainable apparitions and visions, things that seem to almost be bleed through from this apparently not real psychedelic realm. And I just wonder if it is, I mean, I know you said you didn't really like the idea of invoking a dimensional space so much that we're piercing into, but do you think that there is a possibility that there is some form of like perceptual bleed through and they can influence our realm as much as we can enter theirs?
Well, yes, it's possible. I mean, I think, firstly, you know, if you see something out there in the world, you know, if you see it personally and it's just you, then your brain is still, this thing is still kind of part of your world model. It's still part of that model being constructed by your brain. And so there's no conflict there in that, you know, these intelligences could be manipulating your world building apparatus in order to apparently manifest within your external world, just as they might do behind your eyes. I don't think there's any difference there. But clearly, if you're dealing with an intelligence that is, you know, one of these omega minus kind of intelligences that kind of exist beyond space time, or have disappeared into the fabric of space time, or exist in some domain beyond, you know, that it could be some other dimension. I don't dismiss that idea at all. I don't think you're going into, but I think certainly they exist in some other domain. You know, the relationship between our reality and their reality, I think, is completely unclear. But sure, if you're dealing with an entity that can kind of get into, you know, manipulate and infiltrate and direct the construction of your world model in such a dramatic fashion and so effortlessly and you know, with such virtuosity, then I wouldn't put anything past them. So yeah, sure, maybe they could manifest in a, what we would call, you know, quote unquote physical form. I don't really have any conception. I don't think it's possible to have any real conception. You know, I do suppose some ideas in the book, but I don't claim to have any idea what kind of this intelligence is, or where it's from, or from whence it came, or anything like that. I really don't know. I think I don't know if it's possible for me to know.
They're the people I trust the least, the ones that proclaim on the mountaintop that they have understood every element of it and can bring it all down for the rest of us. They're the ones that I trust the least. So you have to go into this with the understanding that the more that you know, the more you realize how little you know. I think that's the true kind of journey of knowledge gathering, is this fundamental realization that you're never going to understand this infinite ocean that is, you know, making up this reality that we're a part of. But I find it so fascinating, this idea of potentially a superposition of states in consciousness. You know, I was recently speaking with Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who's the co-author of the Orchestrated Objective Reduction Theory, the quantum microtubule components in the brain and how these interact with fields. And, you know, this idea of your own consciousness being able to go from a localized perception of your external environment and the sensory input that you receive to a non-local expression, to an expression that is almost like a field phenomena. And perhaps, you know, these entities, these intelligences, they exist within this fine field phenomena, the quantum vacuum, the Akashic record, whichever way you want to look at it, whether you're spiritual or a physicist, these things are now coming together in a way through quantum physics and through quantum biophysics that I think is making a lot of the kind of scientific fundamentalists very uncomfortable, because we are getting into the spooky and the woo and the non-local. So do you think that there is, in a sense, maybe a level of quantum interaction taking place with the brain, interacting with higher fields of information, and perhaps these entities represent, you know, stewards of these higher information fields?
What I propose in the book is, and have, you know, for a while now, is this kind of directed world model, the idea that the visions are, you know, it's not a sensed world or a dreamt world, and, you know, entirely fabricated by the brain, but DMT is somehow gating access. You know, the brain, we can probably talk about this new research a little bit later, but, you know, I kind of hypothesize that DMT pushes the brain into this very fluid and malleable state that allows this intelligent agent, call it that, access, and allows it to direct the flow of information into your brain. And that raises the question of, you know, where is this, how is that working? And it makes most sense that it's coming from very, very deep down, i.e. it could be at the quantum foam level or something, and that it is interacting with the brain. It's not interacting with the brain in the normal, obviously through the normal sense organs. So the information is coming in at some level. And it makes most sense to me, you know, if you are dealing with some kind of intelligence that exists at the foundational level of reality in some way, or at least has access to the foundational level of reality, this is how it would be done. So they would direct from the bottom up. It would be kind of a bottom up process. So yes, your brain would be effectively, and your brain is always linked into the quantum world anyway. I mean, everything goes down to that level. And so I think that's the level at which they would access your brain, and kind of everything emerges upwards from there, which is a great skill to have.
Now, do you think that this intelligent agent, if it is an intelligent agent, do you think that it's trustworthy? Should we be trying to listen to what it has to say? I can't help but think, and even though I'm not someone who belongs to any sort of religious movement, I like to take seriously and respect the thousands of years of mysticism and theological belief frameworks, because I think that there are kernels of truth embedded within a lot of these things. And, you know, there's a cultural myths of the jinn and demons and entities that are just of a lower vibration, things that want to trick you, things that want to try and manipulate human consciousness. So do you think that there is any sort of reason not to trust this intelligent agent?
Oh, I think that should be the default position. The default position should be that they're bullshitting you. Because I mean, you know, the whole ambience of the DMT space is one of mischief and tricks. It's a tricksy kind of experience. And by far, those kind of experiences of people meeting, you know, often just quite explicitly gesture, you know, with the fucking hats and stuff. And like, and there's clearly, you know, something not quite jovial, but one of Rick Strassman's subjects said, you know, there's a something, you know, not quite, something sinister, you know, not the kind of "we're going to get you, motherfucker," but kind of like they could turn on you if they chose to. And so to assume that everything that you, all the information you receive from them.
Right. It's almost like I'm playing with you, but I don't have to play with you.
Exactly.
I could get a bit more serious if I wanted to. Yeah, exactly. I'm just playing with you right now.
And sometimes they do get really very serious. And this is why you have to be very, very careful. When you form belief systems, you can You can say, I mean, I kind of speculate that we are dealing with some kind of intelligence, but I certainly would never, or haven't so far, said, okay, this is what they've told me, and this is kind of what I think is actually going on, because I got it from an entity. I think you have to be very careful here. You end up with, maybe we don't want to get into it, maybe we do, but you end up with seeing codes of reality and lasers and things, and getting that kind of information from entities, and developing kind of ideological positions, and where you kind of know that you've some kind of revealed truth, even though it doesn't stand up necessarily to scrutiny.
Well, I mean, this is a thing as well, is that if we again pay attention to the mystic practices and like the esoteric mystery schools, there is a level of reverence and a level of discipline that is required to traverse these realms. The shaman is someone who is completely trained and is an adept in traversing these realms. And, you know, many of the indigenous cultures, if a Westerner does come in and engage in these practices, they must have a shaman, they must have a guide, they have to have someone to help them go through that experience. So, I mean, I'm all for these, you know, developments through the Western lens of science and technology and, you know, DMTX. But are we prepared? Are we really prepared? Or are we being a little egotistical with our rush to jump even deeper into something that we haven't even learned to truly traverse within the 5-10 minutes?
You could be right. There's certainly an argument for that. It's difficult for me to say that, being the guy that you know, thought of the idea originally. But yeah, I think, I mean, we have...
I'm not knocking the idea.
No. But I agree with you. And I think it's not something to be taken lightly. I will say that. I mean, we do have a long history of people taking DMT generally without incident. Now, does that tend to, will that begin to change as we go to a longer and longer time periods? I don't know. There's no evidence so far that that's the case. There've been no casualties.
Well, I suppose less so about like incident, and more so, you know, how much information can you glean from this if you're not already versed in the practices that have been, you know, done for thousands of years? I think more about, you know, the accuracy of gathering information, because obviously from the scientific perspective, the logical brain, you need to be fusing those two together, the creative mind and the logical mind, when it comes to something like this, right? So the archaic revival, essentially, these shamanistic practices should be fused into the scientific rigor.
I agree, and I think I've always kind of spoken of it as a kind of developing a relationship, a two-way communicative relationship with this place, without going in without judgment as to the kind of entities we're getting involved with, whether they're going to be truthful, whether they're going to be beneficent, godlike beings, or whether they're going to be malicious, menacing, objectionable kind of being, you know, that side, the end of the spectrum. And I think it's what is missing, I think, is a lot of scientists. I would say the majority of scientists, there are very few who are doing these experiments because they are truly interested in establishing communication with, you know, discarnate intelligences. Most of the time, the interest is in what can we learn about how it affects brain activity, and, you know, how can we explain this experience, or explain it away, so to speak. So there's no need in their mind to bring in people who are experts in navigating and who have. I mean, the shamanistic cultures of South America, you know, they have developed relationships and maintained relationships with these beings as they see them, these members of their tribe, as they also see them, for hundreds, thousands of years. So if you want to establish a relationship with them, then they're definitely people to ask. Right, yeah. So I think there is a, you know, anthropologists, they deal with myths and mythology and the religious worldviews of these, and then the scientists, you know, they do the real work, which is to explain these experiences as illusory social events or whatever, and they need to come into contact. But first, scientists need to take more seriously the possibility that you are dealing with some kind of, but that's a massive, it's a massive gulf between where we are now and the scientists putting their hands up and saying, actually, we can't explain this, and maybe that we are dealing with some kind of other intelligence here. When's that going to happen? I mean, I try my best to explain to people why we should do that, but do people listen? I don't know. Maybe not the right people.
I mean, I recognize the dilemma for the scientific mind, but I think because I'm quite an intuitive person, I have an appreciation for that strange place that seems to give us insight sporadically, absent empirical evidence, because that's a fascinating thing. And it happens across the board, you know, in many different ways. And some of the greatest scientific minds of all time, in fact, most of the ones that we herald as the greatest are ones that have sporadic intuitive insight that can't be truly explained, whether it comes through dream or vision. And I think that it's a difficult thing because the logic-based scientific mind, it needs that empirical evidence. But what I've found in a lot of different areas, including actually ancient history and prehistory and some of the capabilities that were present in those periods of time that we just attribute to these Neolithic hunter-gatherers, and lo and behold, we have geometric multi-ton stone building projects, celestially and equinoxially tuned and aligned and acoustically resonant. And, you know, it speaks to, in my opinion, this ability for humans to draw upon extremely complex information and bring it into reality in a way that can't be empirically evidenced at that time, because they don't have the actual data to quantify it. They just have this insight, they just have this realization, and they give us this spiritual quote, or they give us this formula, and we laugh and we laugh and we laugh until science catches up, and then we look back and go, oh my gosh, that was actually what that person was saying the whole time. And I find this fascinating, and it's a massive challenge and a problem, because of course, like a logical scientist isn't just going to base things on intuition from someone who's saying, I'm getting an intuitive feeling. And yet it keeps proving to be pretty bloody accurate throughout time. And so there has to be some sort of a fusion between the intuitive and the logic.
Yeah, I think, you know, the modern post-enlightenment mind craves control over, well, everything, basically. But certainly the idea of giving in to or allowing some, whether it's intuition or whether it's guidance from something else to kind of guide you. I mean, artists do that all the time. If you speak to any of the greatest writers in history, you know, in Cormac McCarthy, when he was asked about, you know, how does he come up with these ideas? And he didn't know. And something, you know, he calls it his subconscious, and maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But he couldn't say how he did it. He just allowed this thing to take control of him. And we accept that within the arts. We can, you know, the muse or whatever, you know, that's kind of, you know, getting in that state where you allow the art to flow through you or flow out of you, so to speak. That's kind of accepted as perfectly normal and natural and maybe even optimal for producing good art. But when it comes to science, it's a different matter. And I'm not saying that you should, all scientists, just give up this kind of the analytics, but you have to strike the balance between, you know, there is, you know, it's become something of a cliche, but it's really a truism, this separation between the left and the right brain. The right brain does see things very holistically, and the left brain does tend to analyze and deconstruct things. And we are very heavily weighted towards the left side, and we don't see the whole picture. We don't have that intuitive sense. We do. And I think that's a problem.
Well, surely the goal is symbiosis. It must be the goal, like, you know, the unifying of these two hemispheres, because like you said, it's actually scaled on a kind of micro to macro level in terms of all sorts of things that should be unified, including the hemispheres of our brain should be interacting in ways that we are not allowing them to interact. And it also feels like our society, I mean, it blatantly obvious that our society is actually built against that from the get-go. I mean, you're not encouraged to expand your mind. You're not encouraged to explore the unknown corridors of consciousness. And so we're actually, especially in the Western hemisphere, I would say, again, hemisphere, these things need to unify, right? Even in the Western world, with the Eastern world and the Eastern traditions, it feels like in our particular world, although, of course, you're currently not in the Western hemisphere, it's like an uphill battle. You're already born into a system that is fundamentally rejecting these values and fundamentally ignoring them and just laughing at them. And so, like you said, how can humanity get to this point? How can we get to that kind of unification? Perhaps through technology, perhaps through some sort of fusion of, you know, quantum physics and models and consciousness evolving. Who knows? Maybe even AI might be able to assist us in bridging some of these gaps between our knowledge sets.
Yeah, or psychedelic drugs, of course.
Or psychedelic drugs.
That's kind of what they do. You know, they dissolve, as Terence McKenna used to put it, they dissolve, they're boundary dissolvers, and they allow information to flow more freely between the left and the right, and, you know, through all parts of the brain, really. And so the distinction, the separateness of the components of consciousness becomes, they become less separate, and you start to see, you know, if you take a psychedelic drug, you start to see the world in that way afresh, as a child does, and before it starts parcelating and piecing together and seeing purely a world of individual discrete objects rather than the unity of this entire unified process. The world is this constantly emerging process. It's not a series of objects. This is very much a left brain thing, is to parcelate and name things and organize things this way, whereas the right is more about relationships and connections. And so we very much shifted towards the left-hand side and ignored. And you see this throughout. I mean, we could talk about this for hours, the way that this is manifest in modern Western society. But we'll probably get into territory that will get you cancelled. So,
well, you know, I tread that territory on a regular basis, and it's always a bit of a risk, especially in the UK these days. You really do not know what you can say and get away with online. But I find it very interesting that children, until roughly about the age of 7 or 8, are primarily in theta brainwave, right? So they're in a very different state of consciousness up until this point of, it's almost like, you know, gradual indoctrination. After a while, they just start to slip into this more concretized understanding of the reality they're in. But before that, they're drifting in a dreamscape. And I think this is not too dissimilar from, you know, the DMT space.
But certainly with psychedelics, there is that sense of not regressing, because that's kind of a negative word, but returning to this much more naive, childlike state of wonder. And we've lost that, I think. Who is it who described the disenchantment? We've become disenchanted with the world, and it becomes very mundane. And there's, when you really think about that, it's a remarkable thing to be here in this world, in this incredibly beautiful and complex world, and it should be. And I guess it's you can't spend your life, you can't function if you are completely awestruck all the time. I guess it's probably not an adaptive state to be in, but to be able to get back to that kind of state, the return to the enchanted forest once in a while, I think is a very positive thing, for sure, and really puts you back in touch with how wondrous and remarkable reality, whatever it is, because I don't know, whatever a reality is, you know. Yeah.
Would you consider yourself a spiritual person?
It's a loaded word, so I would probably avoid, I don't know, it depends how you define spiritual, I guess. But I'm not I sometimes come across to some people as being this hardline materialist or reductionist or whatever, but I'm not that at all. I mean, when I was much younger, I was very, very interested in the occults and ghosts and this kind of thing, and the unseen other, unseen realms, the hidden, that which is hidden or has been hidden. I was really interested in that.
Let me condense it to the survivability of consciousness. Where is your gauge on the survivability of consciousness after this bodily death?
Oh, well, that's a difficult question. I mean, do I believe that?
I mean, has DMT have these like research endeavors like shifted your opinion at all on that kind of an idea?
Well, yes. I mean, certainly, I'm certainly much more open to it. Whether we continue to exist, I think when most people think about surviving, they assume, surviving after death, they assume they exist as they want to keep themselves, right? They want to keep this person, their name and, their nice clothes that they're wearing, and that's what they're talking about. They want to keep themselves as themselves, as this individual, and that's to cross over. Whereas if you look at more kind of ancient traditions, going back, Vedanta or Buddhism, really, the idea that this is the most kind of fundamental and most important message is that all of that is an illusion. That it's not real, right? That's all an illusion. This thing, your name and your occupation, and this thing that we call ourselves, this is just an illusion, and that your true self is something much more fundamental and deeper, and was never born and will never die. So in that sense, you could say, well, I could answer, well, I don't believe it. I don't believe in death, and I don't believe in birth, and that would be a perfectly valid answer, and that might be kind of something that I consider, but from another perspective, do I think that I will continue as me? I don't really know what that means, because my body, I'm not going to take that, and all of that stuff. So what is actually going to be carried over? I mean, that's a really interesting question, right? What am I taking with me? Am I taking my memories and my PhD? Does that come with me? Do I have to start fresh? Is that relevant? What do people mean when they say survive after death? I don't think that's ever made clear. I don't think most people actually think about it. They just want to keep going. They just don't want to die. I think that's what it is.
There's a level of ego embedded in the concern in of itself. But I guess if you looked at DMT potentially as some sort of attributable flash of potential experience, like Terence said, he was once speaking or actually introduced a high-level Buddhist to DMT, who then came back and said, "Those are the lesser lights of the Bardo. That's as far as you can go before the umbilical cord will break and you will not return back to this mortal plane." And so, maybe these experiences are almost like a flash in the pan of what you may experience when you move over. And a lot of the time, when you're in these DMT spaces, your name melts away, right? Your body melts away. Your previous identity melts away. There's still something there. You're still conscious and experiencing something, but you're not you anymore. You're not Andrew. I'm not Jay. So perhaps there is a little bit of a hint within the dynamics of this strange biochemical that seems distributed across all of nature and can be even induced endogenously. Perhaps that is almost a little Easter egg hidden within that's telling you, this is what it's like when you pass over. And you better get used to it and start practicing and get prepared. Otherwise, you're going to be very shocked when you come out of this body and arrive into the DMT space. You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's training.
Yeah, I mean that. So what you I mean you're right though. I mean, when you if you get a good breakthrough hit of DMT, I mean your entire conception of what it meant to be a human is gone. It's not just you forget who you are, but you forget what it means to be a human, and that it's kind of a surprise when that starts. Your brain starts piecing back together your humanity a few minutes later. It's like you get little pieces at a time, and it's like, oh yeah. And then finally, it kind of the whole thing kind of collapses back. But yeah, I think perhaps it's. What was I saying? I was that Ram Dass quote. I was saying on Third Eye podcast just the other day that Ram Dass quote where he says that dying is like taking off a tight shoe. This idea that actually you kind of you unfold into you're kind of held tight within this space, this human life, with all of its sufferings and all the tensions and the constant. It's like constant. It's never you're never quite. It's always something. That's part of the human condition. I don't know what you would call that, but anyway, and then when you die, it's like this unfolding, this natural unfolding into. So there's a continuity of consciousness, the continuity of that fundamental I of self, but not of all that stuff. So I think anyone who thinks, yeah, I'm going to go through with everything intact as I am, I think that's probably, I don't see why that would be the case. But I like the idea of the continuity of consciousness, and that it's impossible for consciousness to be kind of ruptured, in a sense. And so it's just this continuity into this domain where you are still, you still have a point of view, you still have this subjective eye from which you see reality or whatever, but you're kind of unfolding into this release into this high dimensional space where you're, and then maybe you collapse down then into some other temporary existence, and this thing, you know, happens again and again, and then you, that's a type of reincarnation. So you can build kind of an overarching model of what it might look like. So maybe these, you know, the, you see it a lot in, is it, what kind of Buddhism is it? Like, often like Tibetan Buddhism, you see a lot, there's a lot of, and not so much in like Zen Buddhism, that's very austere. But in like Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of these entities, these beings that, that David Luke wrote a paper a few years ago, or quite a few years ago now, where he was confronted by this entity, this horrible thing with many eyes and stuff and arms. And then he found the entity within this book or whatever on Tibetan Buddhism. And so it feels like maybe they are accessing some domain through other means. You know, maybe if you sit and stare at a wall for 20 years, you might be able to access this realm through other means, but DMT is quicker.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And again, that was Terence McKenna's argument, that it's the democratic way, that you don't need to be in the ashram for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you know, disciplining the mind. And then there's a lot of people on the other side that would argue against that and say that it's precisely that discipline that is required to understand and appreciate the experience. So maybe there's a middle ground there. I certainly think that it's a good thing to try and increase the collective usage of these, you know, these substances that are obviously natural and endogenous. And Ram Dass's quote about, you know, unlacing the shoe is a very apt idea, I think, and your mentioning of the word collapsed, I think, is important, because I look at it again, it's this weird self-similarity at scale. You think about the observing of a photon or an electron and how it collapses down into a particle form and then expands out into a waveform when it's unobserved or unmeasured. You could almost look at this as the unobserved or unmeasured human mind, human consciousness. And when it's unobserved and when it's unmeasured, when it's dead from this perceptual kind of antenna that we have that grounds us into a linear experience, this human body with its sensory input is what grounds us into this linear framework. When that's no longer required, what does that consciousness do? Well, it's no longer going to be in this compressed particulate form. It's going to expand out into this wave function. So I think it's attributable. And again, it just scales up, you know, as above, so below, as the old maxim of Hermes Trismegistus. It seems to ring very true.
Yeah, I think so. And who is it? Donald Hoffman. Has this idea about interacting in intelligent, what does he call it, conscious agents, and everything is just the interaction between conscious agents. And so you can imagine that when you have these, I don't know, but, you know, a cluster of these interacting conscious agents, that they, in the same way that you describe when you look at an electron, it kind of collapses. And perhaps there's something to that in the way that when conscious agents interact, you get these very solid, not necessarily solid, very compact, compressed down forms. And then when you detach from, you know, interaction with your consciousness, you enter some other form, or you enter this more expansive form that is neither here nor there, or is here and everywhere. And then perhaps you become, you know, interaction with other agents, and you could postulate these kind of ideas for until the cows come home, but it's just a great mystery, isn't it?
It is, but I do find it very interesting. And some of the people I've spoken to who are kind of like in the computational sciences, and this fractal recursive self-similarity throughout reality, the spirals that go down from the quantum level all the way up to galactic, you know, spirals, and this incredible level of symmetry and geometry and like fractal recursion. And think about these psychedelic experiences, the geometries that you manage to perceive through them. Same with transcendental meditation. The same things that are printed onto every religion, every temple, these cymatic geometries. There's a fundamental connection to this kind of like perfect math, perfect coding. Like you were saying with the people who've been taking DMT and apparently seeing these laser light matrix style coding diagrams popping up in their experience. It would seem the reality, whatever it might be, is in some way simulated or generated, procedurally generated. And there's another very interesting quote that I can't remember who actually gave it, but the idea that the universe is beginning to look less like a giant machine and more like a giant thought. And I find that very interesting. It does feel like reality itself is in some way generative. And when you get into the coding of that, you get these geometries, you get these incredible patterns. Do you think that reality itself is illusionary?
My default position for many years has been that form and content ultimately is illusory. And that I'm kind of outing myself a little bit here. Well, no, I'm not so much. But I mean, I am fundamentally, I would call myself an idealist of sorts, in that I do think consciousness is fundamental. And I think that there are patterns and structures and dynamics and forms that consciousness takes. But ultimately, these forms, they're not the truth of the matter. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I mean, I'm basically talking about, this is what you will read in any book on Vedanta or so on Hinduism, you know, the idea of Brahman being the fundamental reality and everything else is illusion. Everything is a manifestation of everything is a manifestation of the ultimate reality. I mean, this is from the Bhagavad Gita. I actually had I had a dream like 20 years ago. I was wandering through a forest, and I came to an opening in the forest, and there was this beautiful lake. And there was I don't know if it was a being, but something, as I was gazing out over this lake, something said into my head, everything is a manifestation of God. Everything is a manifestation of God. And it kind of hit me, it struck me, and I shut away. And then I went to the computer and Googled it, and it was from the Bhagavad Gita, which I'd never read. Everything is a manifestation of God. I mean, the translation will vary depending on the book. I don't think God's necessarily the correct word, but everything is a manifestation of that, the ultimate reality, the self with a big capital S, or Brahman, or whatever thusness, as Alan Watts might call it, isness. Or something like that. And so that's kind of that's the background to what that's my basic background of my worldview. So I don't take form too seriously. I think all forms, whatever they are, it's all the same stuff. It's all just different manifestations. But I can't write books about that. And I can't get my teeth into that, even though I think that's ultimately what we're talking about here. So I kind of focus on this kind of higher level, which is the brain. You know, ultimately, I think the brain it's a structure, it's a pattern of consciousness. But, you know, I have to be able to talk about it in a way that's meaningful. And that involves doing neuroscience. So that's what I do.
Yes, no, absolutely, right. You know, we're flirting with the ineffable. It is something that can't be languaged in any sort of meaningful sense. And it seems to be something that you almost get a flash picture in a higher density when you're in these psychedelic states. Like you said, when you come back, the memory drains very quickly, not too dissimilar from dreams. And I find the entire it's kind of funny to say the entire idea of the imagination, but the imagination itself feels, to me at least, almost like a metaphysical bridge between this anchor into the physical world and its connection to what seems to be a higher dimensional space. I mean, the imagination, absent any sort of journey into it through psychedelia inside your own mind, unless you're one of those individuals who can't conjure up these things, but many people can, you can create an entire reality inside your own mind. And yet this is a non-physical space, and yet these things can arrive in extreme complexity from seemingly nothing, especially during meditation. Suddenly, again, sporadic insight arrives. So it just feels like this connection between the psychedelic space, the transcendental consciousness space, even the near-death experience space, and the imagination itself all seem to just be varying expressions of the same thing, I would argue.
Absolutely. And you just have to kind of choose your perspective if you're going to make any sense, if you want to make any sense. I mean, some people choose not to make any sense and just choose to remain quiet. And this is a perfectly valid position to take. Whereas other people, they kind of want to... like me, who've got a big mouth and want to kind of talk about these and explicate these things in a language that people understand. And really, I think that what am I trying to do is I'm not necessarily trying to convince anyone that what I believe or what I think is kind of true. I'm just trying to plant seeds of doubt. That's really what I like to do, and that's what I've always done, is to say, hey, your idea here, your hypothesis, your model, let's actually see if it stands up to scrutiny. And once you inject doubt, then you invite further exploration. But there's always going to be this untraversable gulf between the immediacy of subjective experience. I can't explain to anyone what DMT is like. Doesn't matter how eloquent he might be, it's impossible to really transmit the experience as much as it is to transmit the color red with words. You can't do it. But you can, to a certain extent, look at certain features and within the structure of the experience and get people to think, actually, yeah, that is kind of strange how that can happen. And once I connect it with this, with something they do take seriously, which is the sciences, and they take the neuroscience seriously. So once I can connect with that and say, hey, none of this fits into this paradigm, the paradigm fails to explain this. And then hopefully they think, okay, maybe these people who have been saying been interacting with intelligent beings for thousands of years, maybe they are onto something, maybe they aren't. These aren't just the machinations of a primitive mind that haven't had the privilege of being educated in the in Western universities or whatever, but actually maybe they are onto something. That's all I try to do, I think. Inject doubt.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. You know, the need to challenge the status quo on these fundamental things, because there's been such a long-standing, I would say, dismissal of, the woo and, oh, this is just, spiritual new age nonsense. What are you talking about? These ideas around consciousness. But our progression has contradicted that position through science, through the lens of science. You have to articulate, especially to the scientific mind, which is the Western world, essentially, you have to articulate through that language. And that's something that I've, found as well, as I've gone through my own research in very strange areas of conversation, whether it be consciousness or paranormal experiences, is that how you articulate that really can make or break whether or not someone's going to pay you any sort of attention. And a lot of the time, I think, when it comes to these subjects, especially if you've had a breakthrough psychedelic experience, my God, and you're in, that state of, I feel like I've had a Kundalini awakening. I've spoken to many of these kind of people. They're lovely and incredibly open-minded people, but they struggle to articulate due to the excitement, due to the overwhelming nature of what they experienced. And sometimes you need to step back from your own experiences. Sometimes you need to step back from that and figure out the best way to communicate to someone who's not even on that bandwidth to begin with. You have to build up to that. And I think that's exactly what you're attempting to do, is build up to that level of a bandwidth of acceptance through using the tools and the language and the terminology that is acceptable to the status quo whilst disrupting the status quo at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very difficult I tread this very precarious path between, I mean, you know, I always say, you know, most scientists think I'm too far out, and most far out people think I'm not far out enough. So I get kind of attacked on both sides. The scientists say, oh, he's just nuts, you know, thinking about discarnate intelligence and stuff. Whereas the more spiritually minded or mystically minded will say that I'm just this scientist trying to explain the mechanics, you know, using the brain, and so it's very difficult to tread that path and keep friends. And also, of course, there's a lot of bullshit on that mystical side as well, and you have to know the difference between, as Terence McKenna said, you know, shit and shinola. I don't know what shinola is, but
I don't know what it is either, but I love that quote.
I think it's shoe polish. Sounds like a shoe polish.
I'm literally gonna look it up now as we're talking.
It's got to be a shoe polish. You're gonna Google it, right? There you go. Yeah. And that's difficult. It's very easy to get dragged into the schlock of shit, because there are just piles and piles of steaming shit in that area. Because anything goes, you know, anyone can claim to be in, you know, direct communication, the channeling the aliens from Zeta Reticuli or whatever. Anyone can do that,
and they do. They do claim it.
Oh, and they do, and they do. And some of them might be actually doing that. I don't know, but a lot of them just are crackpots. A lot of them are just charlatans and complete frauds and just grifters. And so you don't want to be pulled too far into there and become associated with them, really, because then people don't listen to you. You know, I mean, Graham Hancock has always faced that difficulty in that many people, it's easy to just dismiss everything he says and say, oh, he's just a crap lunatic. You know, it's all woo-woo and lump him together with the other people, you know, all that stuff, the woo kind of thing. And I guess why he struggles more, I think, than me is because he doesn't have that sign. He's not a scientist, and he's never claimed to be a scientist. So, but yeah, there's a lot of intolerance for novel ideas, even if you explain them carefully, and say, you know, this is what I've, these are the conclusions I've come to, and these are why I came to these conclusions, and lay it all out. People will still call you nuts. People still call me nuts, but it is what it is.
Yeah, and it's true, but it's true what you said, and you know, you have to navigate in the same space as I made an X post about this a while ago, and it was quite popular, so I think it was the correct thought to have. And it's the fact that, you know, the closed-minded communities don't want to hear your idea, but the extremely open-minded communities do. So you have to operate within a place where you've got an open mind, but your brain hasn't fallen out. But there's a lot of people in the same place where their brain has fallen out. They're completely open their mind, but you get lumped in with every single one of those by the skeptics. So anyone who's a skeptic of this stuff, who's in the academic world, is very dry and dusty and, you know, sticks to the model, all they see is you being one of those people, exactly as you said. And that's a frustrating truth of having to navigate through these spaces. And I think that the only saving grace is, again, how you articulate yourself, how you present yourself. And the people that do stop to listen will go, oh, you know what, this guy Andrew, he's actually not crazy, he's really done a lot of work into this, and I'll listen. So, you know, you just got to keep plugging away, I guess.
Yeah, I was at Contact in the Desert. Have you been there?
Oh, were you? Yeah, I've spoken there a couple
times. Like a couple of years ago. They didn't invite me back, but I think I don't know why. I think I kind of know why. But
they didn't invite me back this year either. I don't know. I don't know if I've pissed someone off.
But, you know, that was crazy. I mean, again, there you've got, you know, kind of level, a few kind of level-headed, rational kind of people. And then there's just this, like it's just, wow, man, these people are just far out. People in suits, like uniforms. I think there was like I forgot what they were called.
Are they dressed like Navy?
Yeah, they've got military uniform on because this is serious business. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they're Scientologists. They're part of the Sea Org.
Oh, really? I did know the Scientologists were far out, but
mm-hmm. Oh yeah, dude, like they're fully embedded into these conferences, drawing it back into DMT. One of the arguments, again, from like the kind of meditative cultures, is that this is a fast acting way to kind of cheat your way through enlightenment. But can you actually do you think access the endogenous DMT at levels that would allow for a breakthrough experience? Do we require this external stimuli? I mean, clearly the indigenous cultures of the Amazon are very wise to the internal structures and mechanisms of consciousness. I would almost imagine that if you can do this absent an external methodology, they probably would have been doing that unless there's a separate route that they took. So, I mean, yeah, in regards to kind of external versus internal DMT, is there a power to the internalized endogenous system, or do we need that activation from a higher amount externally?
Well, I mean, I see it as like a progression from the forests into, you can see this thread that runs through the history of DMT with these indigenous plant-based drug preparations or plant-based technologies, in my opinion, developed by these indigenous peoples to access these realms and these intelligences. And then it comes through, you know, they kind of escape the forest and it was discovered by Western science, or really it was communist Hungary, but anyway, in the 1950s by Stephen Zara, and then it kind of making its way through, and now we've got DMTX, and so there seems to be this progression of kind of learning to use this DMT technology, if you can. That's what I consider it to be, really, is some kind of technology, molecular technology, and DMTX, I think, is not the culmination of that. I think it's the latest iteration in the development of the learning to use this technology. But then you are, the natural question is, do we need to be infusing DMT into people's brains for hours on end? Or can we hack the brain's endogenous DMT system? And that's something which I think could be possible. And what the problem is, we know that DMT is found in humans. We know, you know, it's been detected since the 1950s in countless studies in blood and urine and cerebrospinal fluid, but we don't know anything about how it's regulated or its function. And so how might we raise DMT levels in the human brain? That's an open question, and that's kind of the next challenge, is to understand regulation of DMT. Once you understand how it's regulated, and we believe, you know, I'm working on a project at the moment, or it's actually being carried out by a team at the University of Florida, but we kind of spearheaded it, which is looking at this kind of peptide, endogenous peptide, which acts as an endogenous regulator or inhibitor of DMT biosynthesis. So we're looking to isolate and characterize this peptide and see, you know, how does this regulatory system work. Once you understand how it's regulated, then you can perhaps think about manipulating it so that rather than injecting someone with DMT, you simply, you know, they lie down in a pod or something with all of their biological needs taken care of, and naturally raise their DMT levels in their brain, and then you can kind of keep them within the DMT space with their own self-generated DMT for much longer. How that would experience would differ, and we don't know, because no one's ever done it, as far as we're aware. Well, not, you know, some people will claim that they can elevate DMT in their brains, but, you know, I've not. Any, there's been no studies of that. You know, maybe it's possible with breath work, for example. I don't know. These things, we don't know.
No, you probably have to journey with a backpack up to the temples of Nepal or something and find the hidden one in the Himalayas where they're still levitating and tripping balls through just their own mind. Like, I'm sure that's happening somewhere. But again, like, you know, you just do not see evidence of this in a widely distributed manner. It does seem like the external process, or at least for now, is required. And another thing that's interesting about DMT, at least based on the testimonials that I've seen from a lot of people on different variations of DMT, for example, smoking it through a pipe versus drinking ayahuasca versus the 5-MeO DMT from the toad. I can't remember the specific toad, but there are a lot of different variants of extracting DMT. And there seems to actually be a difference maker between them. A lot of people will say that smoking DMT will give you this fast acting, almost technological experience. But a lot of people in ayahuasca ceremonies will claim that it's more of the Gaia, the Earth Mother, and some form of goddess. And so do you think that that's more about set and setting? Or do you think that this has got something to do with the actual compound itself being made in different ways?
Well, I mean, I'm of the position that, you know, DMT is DMT is DMT. And I think if you took DMT that is extracted from, you know, Chacruna, Psychotria viridis, you know, the DMT, one of the main DMT containing plants used in ayahuasca, and you took DMT synthesized in a laboratory, I would challenge anyone to tell me the difference and tell me which was which. I don't think there is a difference in that regard.
Have you noticed like a testimonial difference between like the bullfrog DMT and ayahuasca and smoking it? Because I'm sure I've seen quite a significant difference in how people claim it's experienced. Maybe that really is just placebo or like human psychology at play.
The frog you're talking about, Bufo alvarius, I think it's got another name now, but That was his original Latin name. But anyway, that's 5-methoxy-DMT. Anyway, it's not DMT, so this is a completely different experience. Synthetic 5-MeO-DMT is, in my opinion, the same as that extracted from the toad. It's just it's a molecule, and I don't think it helps to invoke the idea that the molecule itself, you don't need that. You don't need to have the molecule carry a memory or whatever, or be attached to a spirit. I think that just muddies the issue. But certainly the set and the setting is important, but not always. For example, a Korean guy emailed me last year. He was like terrified. He went to Peru because he wanted to, as you say, to experience Mother Ayahuasca or, you know, the great spirit of the sky or whatever. And he was, for 3 nights, he was tortured by insectoid aliens. I mean, this guy had a completely, he went in with the right set and the right, completely the right setting, in the Peruvian Amazon, for goodness sake. He was in the right place, but he didn't have that experience that people associate with ayahuasca. He had something that was, as far as he was concerned, he was having experiences with aliens. It's something that, an experience that wouldn't have looked out of place in a modern DMT trip report, in Strassman's study, for example. So I don't think it's as simple as, ayahuasca makes you see nature spirits or whatever, whereas DMT is more technological. Often it's, you know, vice versa, you know, sometimes. Yeah, so I think DMT is certainly a very variable experience, and I think it can be influenced by set and setting, but often, more often than not, it simply transcends set and setting, certainly the higher doses. In ayahuasca, generally, your brain levels will only reach about 20% of what you'll achieve with a couple of lungfuls of DMT vapor. So smoke DMT or vaporized DMT or injected DMT is really on another level, actually, than what you will achieve with even those kind of syrupy of ayahuasca brews. So that could be the difference as well, and that you are completely transcending what you can achieve with ayahuasca with vaporized DMT and entering these more hyper-technological alien realms, for want of a better word. Again, it's so variable and so difficult to pin down. I think it's, yeah.
Do you envision a future where we will be able to interface with greater ease with these realms?
You mean in the absence of DMT?
Not necessarily, but just with the development of, like, you know, DMTX and you know, the widespread acceptance potentially of these things as it begins to become more normalized. Do you think in, you know, let's say 10, 15, 20 years, could there be more of a generalized acceptance and maybe even a desire to interact with these types of realms? Because, again, like, especially in like places like England, we're still so phobic of these types of experiences. And so do you get a sense that there's an actual possibility of a conversation to have on a wider scale within our lifetimes?
I mean, it's interesting because if someone tells you that they are religious, right, and say they believe in the angels and the Mary, the mother of God, or if they believe in Allah and the jinns and things, that's kind of acceptable in society, right? No one's going to say, what the fuck? How weird is that? No, that's kind of normal. And from a young age, you know, at the end of the day at school, we used to say the Lord's Prayer, and we were taught about, you know, that God is watching over us and we're going to go to heaven when we die, and these kind of things. And it's kind of perfectly normal to talk about really quite far out ideas. But if you were, on the other hand, if you then say, oh, I take this molecule, this medicine, this whatever you want to call it, to communicate with these beings, which I believe in, then it's like, there's something wrong with you, and this is you're deluding yourself. This is crazy talk. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. You know, which is more crazy? Believing in something which you can't see, you will never see, that you just have to have faith in, or believing in something which you can meet and have a conversation with, and that is right there, and that cannot be denied in its presence? Which is more crazy? And so we've got the whole thing completely backwards, because I think rationality goes out the window once you start talking about psychedelics, and that's a huge problem. And people won't look at it. If I said that I meditated and contacted the spirit realm, people might think I'm a bit kooky, but most would say, "Oh, that's fine." You know, if he wants to believe that. But if I say I inject a drug, then it's like, ooh. This is a serious problem.
Well, there's a really quite provocative and quite upsetting clip. I don't know when it was filmed, but it was in black and white. You might have come across this before. And it's a young man who's in a psychiatric hospital, and he's being interviewed about why he's in a psychiatric hospital. And he's in there because his mother has put him in there. And his mother put him in there because he was taking LSD. And he was coming out with extremely expansive ideas that just terrified his, I believe, 1950s, 1960s parents, who were extremely rigid. And so the psychiatrist is asking, you know, all sorts of questions. Oh, well, so what is it that, you know, amazes you so much? And he just sounds like someone who has truly had a glimpse of some more expansive reality. He's not crazy. He doesn't sound like he's babbling. And yet, when it cuts back to his mom, it's like, I just can't tell you how terrifying it is to have your son come to you and say, Mom, I've met God. I've met God. It's like, no, honey, you only meet God when you die. Don't say these things. It's like, dude, like, you know, it's like such a small mind, and you feel sorry for these people. But that is still the way that we are. We have moved forward a little, but we're still very much in that knee-jerk reaction. You should never be able to prove the miracle. You should only ever believe in the miracle.
Right, that's it. Yeah, so yeah, we have moved on a little bit,
you know. Mm-hmm. There's a danger to that. Yeah, you should only, you know, I think that is, quite frankly, I do think that's quite monotheistically enforced. You think of, you know, the religious doctrine, especially in Britain, that we've been under for so many years, thousands of years. And so, you know, you come out of this shamanistic and paganistic world, and that was completely eradicated by the fundamental monotheistic religions. And I think that rigidity and that kind of suppression and boxing in of the idea of God, the idea of what a universal consciousness might be, and packaging it in this way, even though for the most part, I would say in the UK, religion is essentially dying off, and not many people would consider themselves in the younger generations as Christian. In the back of the consciousness, of the cultural fabric, it still seems to be present, this type of kind of rejection of the absurd, even if the absurd is objectively experienceable through these methods. You know, it's still a rejection of it just on outright, you know, grounds.
Right, exactly. And so how do you, that's something you need to cross that and overcome that before we can reach the stage where people are saying, you know, let's spend lengthy periods of our lives in interaction with these beings, whether it's through DMTX or through some other technology, you know, endo DMTX or something like that. That's kind of that's a vision of the future, if you like, is where we're constantly in contact. You know, the indigenous peoples have been saying that to them that they describe these beings as members of their tribe, and they're always in contact to some degree with them, and they're always there. And then they kind of dip into direct communication by using these drugs. And so I can imagine that, but in a, you know, sort of a 21st century version of that. But it's the same idea that you take the idea that you are dealing with some kind of intelligence seriously, and then you decide to enter into some kind of communicative relationship with that intelligence. And maybe that is what is necessary for our progression as a species. But I think we're too focused on, you know, sending rockets to Mars, and we've got a failure of imagination about what the future of humanity looks like, even though it's changing so rapidly that we don't know what the future is going to look like in 5 years, really. And yet we still have this very rigid idea of what technological advancement means. People talk about climbing the Kardashev scale. You hear that all the time, the idea that we're going to become spacefaring and colonizing Mars and things like that. And
well, I think the technological landscape is just evolving so rapidly in our timeline, and as I briefly mentioned before, just artificial intelligence kind of bootstrapping human research capabilities in various industries, biomedicine and physics and mathematics and simulation of, you know, high level energy experiments. There's so much that's being streamlined through AI that I do get the sense that Terence was right about this archaic revival. It will come through the medium of quantum physics and biophysics and consciousness studies and things that are academic, things that are scientific, but it's going to inevitably dig deep enough into that structure that it's going to start discovering what we, you know, hasten to say spiritual, mystical, esoteric, the things that are ineffable and not very explainable. And DMT just seems to be this fundamentally strange threshold barrier. It sits right on that nexus point between human existence and this completely incomprehensible abstract realm. Exploring that realm seems like such an important endeavor, especially because it is connected to our own consciousness. Even if we can't fully explain it, we journey there through our consciousness, through our perception. This is a part of us. It is a part of the human experience, albeit very novel and not very experienced by most people. And I think it's Terence that says, you know, it's terrifying, the idea that, you know, you could go to the grave without having a psychedelic experience. It's like going to the grave without having a sexual experience. It should be a fundamental thing that you go through. And I would agree with that, actually. I do think that it's one of those fundamental things that you should pass through the eye of that needle at least once in your life to get that type of an idea of what are these people really talking about. Again, experience being the greatest teacher.